This episode is brought to you by Thorn, and I have some incredible news for any of you that are in the military, first responder, or medical professions. In an effort to give back, Thorn is now offering you an ongoing 25% off each and every one of your purchases of their incredible nutritional solutions. Now, Thorn is the official supplement of CrossFit, the UFC, the Mayo Clinic, the Human Performance Project, and multiple special operations organizations. I myself have used them for several years, and that is why I brought them on as a sponsor. Some of my favorite products they have are their Multivitamin Elite, their Whey Protein, the Super EPA, and then most recently, Cinequil. As a firefighter, a stuntman, and a martial artist, I've had my share of brain trauma and sleep deprivation, and Cinequil is their latest brain health supplement. Now, to qualify for the 35% off, go to thorn.com, thorne.com. Click on sign in and then create a new account. You will see the opportunity to register as a first responder or member of military. When you click on that, it will take you through verification with GovX. You'll simply choose a profession, provide one piece of documentation, and then you are verified for life. From that point onwards, you will continue to receive 35% off through Thorn. Now, for those of you who don't qualify, there is still the 10% off using the code BTS10, behind the shield 10, for a one-time purchase. Now, to learn more about Thorn, go to episode 323 of the Behind the Shield podcast with Joel Totoro and Wes Barnett. Welcome to the Behind the Shield podcast. As always, my name's James Gearing, and this week it is my absolute honor to welcome back onto the show British military veteran turned conservationist, Harry Turner. Now, this time I was actually talking to Harry from the middle of the rainforest, so a really powerful and beautiful episode, and you can literally hear the incredible nature that surrounds him. And we dove into another spectrum of topics, from his continual mental health healing journey, deforestation, poaching, his non-profit Emerald Arch, and so much more. Now, before we get to this incredible conversation, as I say every week, please just take a moment. Go to whichever app you listen to this on, subscribe to the show, leave feedback, and leave a rating. Every single 5-star rating truly does elevate this podcast, therefore making it easier for others to find. And this is a free library of well over 1,100 episodes now. So all I ask in return is that you help share these incredible men and women's stories so I can get them to every single person on planet Earth who needs to hear them. So with that being said, I welcome back onto the show, Harry Turner. Enjoy. Well, Harry, I want to say two things. Firstly, welcome back to the Behind the Shield podcast. And when I ask, where are you today, you're probably going to have a cooler answer than any of the other 1,100 plus guests I've had so far.
So, yes, I'm currently on the plot of land that we just bought in the Ecuadorian Amazon. I wasn't sure if I was going to have service. So if it does cut out, I do apologize, but it's just the kind of name of the game out here. But yeah, I'm in the Ecuadorian Amazon on our plot of land, which is 184 acres.
Amazing. Amazing. Well, I want to get to that. We first spoke in January 2024. For everyone listening, if you haven't heard episode 878, then you need to hit stop. Go listen to that first and then come back and play this. So give me an overview. January last year, what are some of the big changes that have occurred, not only as far as the nonprofit and the book, but also even your own kind of a mental health and emotional journey?
Yeah, I feel like, so next month I'm going to be 32 years old. And for a lot of people, that's still quite young. And for me, I kind of, back in the days of, you know, contemplating suicide every day, I never even thought I'd get to this age. But I've progressed a lot in my mental state in regards of I now understand a lot of the reasons why a lot of the bad things happened. a lot of the times for me, in the moment, you don't understand the importance of that traumatizing experience or that experience which you just think is a pain in the ass. It's everything is kind of like making you and guiding you to do the things that you need to do. If I had never, you know, I didn't necessarily fail at school, but if I didn't like do very well at school, I never would have been, you know, pushed to do the army. If I hadn't have gone to Afghanistan, I never would have gone to the Peruvian Amazon to commit suicide. If I hadn't have had that epiphany moment on the boat, I never would have continued to stay. If I had never have done all these things, I never would have been the person I am today. And it's obviously taken me quite a while to understand the fact that these traumatizing and these moments that you really just truly think are just negative can actually be very, very powerful and impactful and pivotal moments in somebody's life. And so when you're feeling super, super down, I now realize that then points in my life are actually important and I should actually acknowledge them instead of just brushing them under the rug. Like we have up days, we have down days. When I'm in the jungle, I have my up days, but I do have some down days. But I've found that just with, you know, since the last podcast, my kind of viewpoint on life has changed quite a bit because I've been able to kind of like take the negatives and take the bad moments and kind of like look at them in a better light.
I remember in the documentary and then when we spoke, you know, you went home, your parents came to visit. When you reflect back now, this is interesting. When you go home, leaving this extremely natural, environment that we would have been surrounded by, obviously not in England as far as the Amazon specifically, but that much more basic natural environment, did you find any level of jarring when you were dropped back into the urban or the suburban setting?
Yeah. So when I originally left Peru in 2019 to go back for the first time in a long time, back to the UK, which was captured in the documentary, I remember having extreme anxiety and panic attacks. It was December of 2019. And I remember going out with my parents and a few of their friends just to go get a few drinks down at the local pub, and fireworks were being set off and I could not help myself apart from freak out. I've never been one to love fireworks, but with my trauma in Afghanistan, fireworks unexpectedly can really put me in a bad place. And I just remember being surrounded by these loud bangs and like looking at everybody just laughing and having fun and being drunk. And I've been sober for 12 years now. So like I wasn't drinking then either. And I just remember thinking like everybody is so disconnected. Like we appreciate these loud bangs and we have 20 conversations drunk with all these people and everybody's stepping outside to have cigarettes. And it was just like one of these things where I went back and was just like, what have we become as humans, you know, and what do we see as normal? I've just come back from a 3-day excursion. And it was one of them moments where I didn't charge my phone for the whole time because I didn't need to use my phone. I didn't miss anything apart from, you know, a nice shower or dry feet. I was in the moment. I was listening to the monkeys. I was, you know, bathing in the streams. We were catching fish from the streams to eat for breakfast the next morning. We found a few species of snake. We were tracking different tapir and different kind of animals like mammals in the jungle. And I brought one of my friends from America with me. His first time in the Amazon, his first time, you know, going deep, you know, off trail, just cutting and going. And as much as it destroys the body, it enriches the soul. And it's one of them things where it's like a lot of people these days never, ever push themselves to the point of breaking. That breaking point for so many people is not being able to go onto Instagram and not being able to kind of like talk to their family for a few days. Like, my breaking point is putting me in the deepest, darkest, most grueling experiences to find that one gem of the forest. And that's pushing myself. And I thrive off of feeling that.
One thing I've observed with all of the inputs that we have, I've made this observation a few times here. If you go to a restaurant in America, it is almost impossible to sit down and not have TV screens in the restaurant itself flashing at you, Fox News and football and, you know, whatever the thing is. And then you've got, like you said, the cell phones. And I find that there is this buildup of this kind of inner monologue, you know, that monkey mind just gets louder and louder and louder. What do you experience after that kind of detox from all the electronics, all the external stimulus, when you find yourself back in the rainforest again?
It's definitely a cleansing. It's one of those things where you go out into the forest, and for the first few days, you'll want to take photos of absolutely everything because you want to be able to kind of say, look, hey, you know, Lexi, I, you know, photographed this really cool animal and I've taken a video and here we go. But I find that when I go into the forest and when I'm here, especially if I've completed the majority of what I need to complete around here, then the use of technology just goes down. I get told, you know, I'm trying to fundraise for my nonprofit, I'm trying to do all these things, and everybody's like, Harry, we need content, we need this, you need to film yourself doing this, you need to film yourself for a minute a day. A minute a day is nothing, but I, when I'm here, don't have the time to film myself for a minute a day because I'm so lost in doing everything else. As soon as the sun, you know, you have to work with the energy of the forest, the climate, you know, the weather. And as soon as the sun comes out after a few hours of rain, I know that I need to go to find some snakes. I know I need to like specifically go to specific areas. And when the rain is happening, it's like, what can I do now? You know, I find when I go back to England and I find when I'm, you know, back home in the US, I enjoy being lazy. And like you said, like when you go to a restaurant, like the sound of baseball games, basketball games, different conversations, people playing music on their phone or people, you know, scrolling Instagram, like it's just a huge kind of like buzz, and it's not the buzz of cicadas. It's the buzz of electronics. And it really is an interesting thing, you know, because there's a happy medium. I can't live here full time all the time. I have done that. And you can see in the documentary that I did that for years, and my mental health was not of the greatest. My physical was pretty bad. Imagine drinking stream water for, you know, like 2.5 years straight. You know something's died in there. You know something's defecated in there. Like, I have got to a point now where my health is like, I don't know, 89%. It should be 100%, but it's a little bit less. But there needs to be a happy medium when it comes to stuff. And I feel like a lot of places where you have the best of everything, you never feel that kind of like, you never feel that kind of struggle that you, because this is a struggle, but it's a great struggle.
It's funny what you said about the kind of white noise of electronics versus cicadas. We have cicadas, you know, based on the season here in Florida, and we have, you know, the crickets and we have the bullfrogs and all these other things. And I can sit on my back porch, which is a very kind of tight suburban neighborhood, but huge amount. You'd love it here. So much wildlife. Yeah. It's kind of grown over the last decade or so. All kinds of hawks. And I mean, just it's absolutely stunning. Actually, I sent you a picture of that owl that came on my son's birthday 1 year. Then someone will fire up lawnmowers, weed whackers, etc., because, you know, the problem with Florida in the summer is that we're constantly cutting our grass. And two similar sounds, but completely different to the soul. The cicadas, you know, the nature, I find it soothing. The moment someone's weed whacking, you know, two yards over, I have to go inside. It just annoys the shit out of me. So you can even kind of see, you know, that contrast. You can have a lot of noise somewhere that's beautiful, and it actually is kind of soothing. You can have a lot of noise in the middle of a sports bar, and you kind of want to throw a television through a window. So
for sure, I have that issue here. This issue that I have in the Amazon is based around oil companies. Oil companies in the Ecuadorian Amazon especially are the number one destruction of this place. I just recently went to an oil spill where they said they had cleaned it up. I went in, I went to the front gate. I told them that I was like a journalist. You know, I made up some bullshit story just to try to get in. And they were like, nah, like our boss is on holiday. And the reason he's on holiday is for the fact that he doesn't want to be in contact with anybody because this oil spill is going to cost him his job if it's not done properly. Oil spills happen all the time here. So I was like, look, I can't go this route. Which way can I go? So I jumped on a boat with the Cuyabeno Rangers, which are the rangers of the reserve here. And we spent 9 hours basically. Well, we spent 4.5 hours getting to the oil spill. And we walked around, I documented it, I filmed. It was definitely not cleaned up. And then we got back on the boat and we spent, you know, another 4.5 hours coming back. And grueling day, you know, bushwhacking, looking for, you know, horrible oil spills, and saw a little bit of death and destruction on the way. And it was, you know, horrible. But oil companies in this area are the number one reason for deforestation and destruction. The second is obviously people's farms. You know, people cut down specific hectares for specific things like growing fruits and vegetables, mainly cows. There's people with sheep and goats around here as well. But if you were to look at the destruction of both of them side by side, the oil definitely, as soon as it touches water, it disperses into absolutely every place. If you were to look at people with rates of cancer in this area, the numbers have gone up dramatically since the oil companies have been in this place, and they've been drilling and dumping crude oil and all these things. So I have these sounds that you can probably hear right now of birds and all these things, but I also have the oil trucks that drive past the road, which is, you know, not 200 feet from my house. And it's one of them things where, as Emerald Arch, we really want to do everything that we possibly can to help this place. The problem that we have is funding. Funding is a huge thing. And the second thing we have is time. Oil companies right now are looking at a plot of land that we were looking at recently, and the issue that we have is that they're trying to buy a small plot of land right next to where we want to buy for double the amount that we can pay. And so my relationship with local communities and local families down here is extremely important so that we can actually navigate that very slippery slope of, look, this for you selling to the oil companies is great temporarily. If you sell to them, you're going to have a wad of money, but your family and the streams and the animals and everything around you is going to be completely destroyed, completely die off. However, if you wait until we raise a little bit more money, we will still allow you to work on your farm. We will own the area. We will make a reserve. We will do all these things, and you will have a wage, and you will have the money from the land. Like, we're trying to work with people in a very specific way here that isn't just a Westerner or a Western organization coming in, but a friend and somebody who wants their health and their family's health to be number one priority. Oil companies don't care. They care about where can they drill the most oil. Okay, Ecuadorian Amazon is one of the hot spots for oil. Where can they drill? The reserve, which is just on the border of the lands that we are looking to buy and the land that we currently have, that reserve is the biggest area of oil in the whole area. if it wasn't for tourism, that place would be completely destroyed. If it wasn't for local organizations wanting to buy areas of land outside of the reserve to stop the oil companies drilling into the reserve, it's going to get destroyed. If it wasn't for local people and education, local people would basically be selling to the oil companies so that they could get a little bit of money quickly, and then the rest of their health is going to go down the drain. So the issue that I'm currently going through right now is building relationships with people, but not forcing them to want to do anything for money, but wanting to do it for the correct reasons.
Are these Ecuadorian companies or from other nations?
A lot of this is Texaco and Chevron. You also have Ecuadorian companies, which are, you know, subcontracted to drill this oil and to do all these things, but it gets just distributed across the entire world. A lot of it most likely going towards the US. And the people here get paid pennies. When I went to the oil spill, I actually saw people trying to clean it up, and I asked them, and it was actually their land. You know, they didn't ask for this. They didn't ask for the oil companies to drill there, but they were getting paid by the oil companies to clean up their land because of the oil company's error. I didn't ask them personally how much they make, but one of my good friends here who I'm partnering with, and whose family's land is the land that we want to buy, he told me that, you know, these people are probably getting paid $600 a month to clean this oil, and the detriment that has on their health is disgusting. $600 for a few months to clean up their land that they didn't, you know, want. They didn't want this issue. And if you're surrounded by crude oil, and if you're surrounded like by all of these different things, then it's going to cause some problems. But it's kind of one of the things where it's like, you know, the local salary around here is below $450 a month. So if an oil company is going to give you $600, it's one of them things. So it's another thing that we're trying to kind of like negotiate on and try and figure out is like, what can we do, which is going to incentivize these people, but at the same time, like not overwhelm them.
What is it that's created the need for jobs? And what I mean by that is, you know, most of us, if you go far enough back in our lineage, we're living off the land. We're somewhat self-sufficient, didn't need a big corporation to work for, or, you know, that kind of thing, especially if you're talking about, one would imagine, somewhere like the Amazon. So how was that shift from being able to simply live off the land and not need an air quotes job to this leverage that these companies have now because these people are required to earn actual, you know, money, currency?
Because of the oil company's presence, it's up the price of quite a few things in Amazonian towns. So because of that, people now need to earn more money. The two things that Ecuador brings, that brings money is oil and is tourism. That's it. The region that I am in Cuyabeno and the reserve has a area which is full of oil but is protected by tourism. I'm also near the Colombian border, so that also gives a huge issue because of drug cartels and everything like that. But excuse the parrots. But the issue that we have is that, okay, if you work for the oil companies, you're gonna get disregarded, you're gonna basically, you know, do all this hard labor. If you work for tourism, you need to learn English. And because the majority of people coming speak English. And so a lot of the people don't want to speak English. They don't want to do these things. So they go the route of oil companies because it's the thing that they know the most. It's the most local for their tongue. And the education that Emerald Arch is trying to bring here is that you don't need to speak English and you don't need to work in tourism if you want to protect the land. We want to, once we buy this new plot of land, which is 3,144 acres, it's a huge plot of land, and I need to raise about $1.3 million just for that land alone. The thing that we are going to do is we're going to make park rangers. I would love to employ female park rangers, because a lot of the times around here it's like a more masculine job, you know, go out and do this. But the amount of women out here that actually want to go out and do cool things and be a park ranger or be a guide or be something, it's one of them things where, like, me and my wife and my team of Emerald Arch have sat down and we've said, like, we want to do what we can to help the local community members. We don't want to come in as Westerners with our, you know, light-colored hair and our light-colored skin and basically be the bosses. We don't want to do that. We weren't born here. This is not our land. This is their land. They know it best. So who better to run the ranger program than local people? And if they don't want to learn English, like, that's completely fine. I don't want to force somebody to learn a language. When I was at school, I was kind of forced to learn French at one point, and I couldn't stand it because I didn't have the incentive to learn French. I then got told that I'm too stupid, basically, to speak another language, so they did extra English and extra math and, you know, all this other crap. But it's one of these things where it's like, I want to empower people here to do the things that they want to do, but give them the opportunity. Everybody here wants to protect the forest. That's the thing. But they just have a more incentivized plan from the oil companies because it's more cash in their pockets.
Well, it's interesting because there's two contrasts in my mind when you're saying that. Firstly, I've spoken to a few people when the kind of backstory of Somali pirates comes up, and Seaspiracy is another good place to kind of learn this backstory. You hear about the overfishing of the seas off Somalia and all the fishermen that were able to make money and feed their, you know, village and feed their family. You know, the ability to fish went away. I mean, these mega, you know, ships were coming in and trawling, and there were hardly any fish left for anyone to actually, you know, bring home that they've been doing for arguably hundreds, if not thousands of years. And so then you have this very judgmental, well, these Somali pirates, and, you know, we're all, you know, applauding when they're killed because they took our, you know, American ship. And I understand that at that moment, 100%. But when do we take ownership of, you know, the origin story? And the same with this, you know, if you didn't have these oil companies coming in the first place and then creating this supply and demand and raising up prices, you know, would you even have this issue at the moment? No, you wouldn't. Conversely, one of the best things that I've seen on my travels, and this is Fiji, so it was developed, you know, it wasn't, you know, as remote as you're talking about now, but I went during the coup. It just happened that right, you know, when my girlfriend at the time, we had a round the world ticket, a few days before we were going to leave, they're like, oh, there's a military coup going on. And I was like, well, let's just see what that looks like, because, you know, I know how things are reported. And in Fiji, they will go in, they'll occupy the government building, they'll sit down, they'll drink kava together. And everyone knows kava kind of chills you the fuck out anyway. So it's not like they're, you know, drinking Jack and fist fighting each other. And they talk about it. And basically a shot is usually never fired. So we ended up just going. We said, screw it, we're going to go anyway. But as you can imagine, a lot of tourism was deterred. So we end up doing the paddy open water dive at a place called Mike's Dive Shop. And what he had done is, as an American guy, he'd opened a dive shop, but he'd integrated the local Fijian village. So we, for example, went on a dive and we saw Morgan's Wall, and Morgan was in the boat. You know what I mean? He was the one that discovered it. And this is Fijian guy was one of our guides. And then we went after to the village and we drank kava with the chief. And, you know, it was phenomenal. But just like you said, the American guy came in and created a business, but basically everyone that worked with him, I wouldn't say even for him, he integrated the local Fijian village and the Fijian people and kind of brought a way for them to make money. So very, very different what you're talking about. You can, with industry, come in and kind of integrate with another nation, with another group of people, but there's a difference between working with them and them working for you.
For sure. I, you know, as you're mentioning, you know, all these things, I have these thoughts in my head. And I just said, like, I come off of a 3-day expedition. And I went out with my friend Roger, who's from the US, but originally German. My friend Hilva, who's a entrepreneur here. He has 2 lodges in Cuyo Bueno, very great Ecuadorian dude. And then 2 of his friends, Samuel and Jairo. Jairo basically earns $450 a month. He's got 2 kids. He's got a wife. You know, he works his absolute ass off. Samuel probably earns about $200 a month. He owns everything that he can carry on his back. But yet, these people with very limited resources, these people with hardly anything, are the happiest people I have ever met in my life. Happiest. Jairo, we were just like, you know, we hiked and hiked and hiked all day yesterday. We were trying to get to this one point on the GPS, but it was swamp everywhere. We're up to our chests in places. Like, they were like, where do we go? And I'm like, we've got to go over here. We've got to do this. He's just joking and laughing. And I'm like, dude, like, this is serious. Like, we got to get to this point. If we don't get to this point, we're stuck in the middle of a swamp all night. He's like, nah, you know, it's all good. It's all good. Anyway, we make a decision to come back. We get to camp. We start eating. Start cooking. And then Jairo just gets in the stream and he's just like, you know, playing about in the water. And this is like a 38, 40-year-old man, you know, just like living his best life. He used to work for the oil companies and I had a conversation with him about it. He was like, anything, I would do anything apart from work for the oil companies. He was like saying how he used to walk with big drills and like oil pipes and all these things 6, 7, 8 kilometers into the forest so they could test for the oil. And he was getting paid $25-$30 a day for that. And it's like, that's an hourly salary in Seattle, you know, because me and my wife live in Seattle. Like, that is outrageous. But here he is, you know, cutting trails with us, scoping out new locations, you know, cooking, you know, things that we've caught in the stream, just playing, just having fun. Like, some of the people that I have met in indigenous and local communities are the happiest people that I've ever met in my entire life. Had a conversation with Hilva recently, who's the guy who owns the plot next door, the entrepreneur guy, you know, he is a great guy. And I remember just being really down one day. Can't remember exactly what it was. It could have been anything, to be honest. But he said, why are you depressed? Why are you sad? And I was like, well, I can't really explain. You know, I have complex PTSD. I was at war. I have seen a lot of death. You know, when Khan was killed, that destroyed me. I've been through, you know, I've been through quite a lot in my life, which has now shaped me, but it still doesn't take away from the fact that I'm not fragile. Every human has a fragile point, and you can be tough and tough and tough, and you can work through it and you can do everything, but there's always going to be that soft spot that you definitely still have. And I said, have you ever had depression, Hilva? And he was like, yeah, I think so. I said, okay, well, what was it? He said, well, when my brother died, I was sad. And I was like, of course, your brother died. Like, that's not something small. That's a huge thing in your life. And he goes, yeah, but you know, he died. I felt sad. And then I realized I live in this beautiful place with my beautiful family. And I'm so grateful for everything that I have. And my brother wouldn't want me to be sad. And I'm like, dude, if everybody had your mindset, this world would be so different, so different.
What are you seeing as far as the villages that some of these men and women are growing up in? Because if we kind of wrote down, you and I, okay, what are the things contributing to trauma in, you know, people our age, and obviously you're younger than me, in the Western world,
it would by a lot. You know, it would be everything from, you know, unaddressed childhood trauma and, you know, all these kind of things. And then you go into war or the first responder professions and all these other areas. That simply, you know, a lot of it you kind of realize, oh, these are all Western problems. So, you know, what are you seeing as far as the community level that these, you know, people that you're working alongside in Ecuador have? Because one of the big things that's glaringly obvious in the UK and America is, you know, you have this household and then at 18, get out, go get your own place, you know, and then they're struggling and they're drowning in debt and trying to keep them, you know, above their mortgage or their rent. And you look at a lot of, you know, the older style communities around the world, and you look at our history, if you go far enough back, they say it takes a village. It was a village. You didn't leave at 18. You know, became the hunter or the warrior or whatever it is, but you were still in the village. And a group of people helped raise your children. And there were elders that you would, you know, respect and listen to their wisdom, and there were healers. And so, you know, you see the Iroquois and some of these other people, these other groups that have been written about, where, you know, Westerners in you know, the early settler times were actually going back to the native tribes because the quality of life was better than the cities that they were from. What are you seeing in, you know, these kind of upbringings, that's these incredible people that you're working alongside, as far as their communities in contrast to the UK, the US, etc.?
So just to put this into perspective, Hilver is my good friend, basically a business partner down here, and I have got to know him and his community. He lives in a small town called Pasibien. There's 330 people that live in Pasibien. 240 of them are his family.
Oh my God.
So he is surrounded by family. His network is family. If I have an issue, all I say in that whole area is, I'm friends with Hilver. Done. Whatever you need. So the community here is very family orientated. Also, if somebody's sick, everybody pitches in a few bucks, because that's the way it's done. Like, if it's basically as if there is a constant GoFundMe for everybody, because it's like, how can somebody pay this $600 bill? Okay, there's 300 people here. Each one of you give $2. Done. The community that they have is a huge net and a web of love and celebration. Ecuador is apparently known as one of the most celebrated countries in the whole entire world, because if it's someone's birthday, they celebrate. If it's New Year's, they celebrate. If somebody dies, they have a celebration of life. You know, like, they celebrate absolutely everything. If the women win the football match, everybody celebrates. It doesn't matter who won or who lost. There might be a few tears, but everybody celebrates. Everybody here is wildly connected to each other, which has its pros and also has its cons. You know, if I'm trying to date and 240 people are my family, then it's going to be a bit of a small pool. And I've, you know, spoke to a few people about that kind of issue around here, and they're like, yeah, like, you know, I tried doing this and tried doing that, but da, 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 da. It's like, yeah, like, that could be a big con. But yeah, no, it's kind of like one of them things. It's just like, I see the happiness in them, and they figure out the issues together as a group of people. It's a truly beautiful thing. And I love it when I bring my wife here, because they know who I am, and they bring her in with love, you know. And when I bring my friends, I go, oh, by the way, you know, he doesn't speak Spanish, but like, he's a good egg. And they're like, oh, okay, yeah, come on, let's go and have food, and let's have drinks, and let's have conversations, and let's go to the forest for 3 days and thrash our bodies to oblivion. And it's like, yeah, like, here, if you respect people, you are respected. Whereas in a lot of other countries, because of the disconnect, there's a disrespect.
When you talk about 300 people chip in $2, it immediately reminds me of the NHS. Not the kind of dismantled NHS that we see at the moment, but the core of the philosophy of what it was supposed to be. And I've talked about, you know, I love these conversations where people are in different countries, especially if they've come from one and they see another one. You know, I lived in Japan for 15 months. You know, I mean, all places all over the world have great ideas and great philosophies mm-hmm. and great principles, to, you know, based on their culture and some of the solutions to problems. And the NHS is one of the ones over here. You've seen it. You heard it. Oh, socialized medicine. Like everyone's goose-stepping around the wards and throwing up freaking, you know, Hitler signs. It's like, no, it's just people taking care of people. And when I was young, as you alluded to, thank you very much, a lot longer than, you know, long further ago than you were, you know, it was, you just, that's what happened. You got ill, you went to the doctor and you came out. And even recently, even though it was, a worse experience as far as, the time it took him, my dad had a knee surgery complication through a clot in his lung and had to go to the NHS hospital for a few days. And he just walked out. Didn't have a bill that he's going to have to refinance his home now to pay. He just left with all this equipment and then all these kind of follow-up visits and rehabs and all these other things. And this is where I think there's a huge disconnect again. If you look at the most basal human model, there was no ancient tribe that was like, well, let me see your insurance. You know, you got sick, you were just taken care of. And this is one of the things I think the British have done very well. And it's a shame they've allowed the American system to kind of corrupt it. Is at its core, we said we will take care of each other. And the beautiful side effect of that when it was running properly is now the incentive is to make the nation healthy. So we use the least amount of tax money. But what's happened now is the privatized, American system has pushed its way in. And I don't know if you've noticed this, but, the British are getting fatter and sicker, just like the Americans. And it's tragic because it's a complete, abuse of the British and the American population so that these drug companies can profit from them.
Pharmaceutical companies are also another big reason that the Amazon is being destroyed, which is a topic that not many people talk about. But the majority of the medicines that we get are from natural places. And the Amazon is full. Like, we went out on a hike and we went through some pretty rough terrain. Ticks and, there's little mites out here called chiggers. And there's like a bunch of other like bits and pieces out here. Everything we need is in the forest. If we want to cleanse our body, there's all these different things. There's a garlic plant out here where it's just like the leaves and the roots of gut. You just chew on the garlic leaf. Man, you wouldn't want to kiss me afterwards, but like it does its job. It eradicates the fleas, the ticks, the mites, like everything. It cleanses your body. If you are, dehydrated, there's the bamboo, there's the different roots and vine systems, there's like small pockets of streams that are clean enough to drink from. Like everything here has a purpose, and everything that the pharmaceutical companies are doing are taking from here and making it expensive so that you can feel healthier. I've been playing the long game, honestly. In the US, I still don't have insurance because I'm like, at this point, it's actually comedy just to kind of like see how long I can go without doing myself over. But it's sickening. The reason why people stay in these 9-to-5 jobs with these corporate companies and they don't pursue or follow their dreams is because they can't afford their health insurance. And I'm the type of person where I'm never, ever going to stick to a 9-to-5. When I go home, of course, I work and I earn some money so that I can come back to a place like this. But honestly, like the fear that the government and the countries put into people so that they stay is sad. It's truly sad.
It's funny you say that because I haven't had health insurance for several years. I'm actually just about to get it. My wife graduated med school. So she actually, I think in 2 weeks, so hopefully I don't get hit by a bus before then, we'll actually have insurance again. But, I left the fire service, left all, the pensions and the health insurance and all the other things so I could do this. But by doing this, I took a pay cut. This is not making a lot of money, but it's not the currency that I care about. I care about, connecting all these guests with the people that need to hear what they're talking about and hopefully, making their lives better. But it is, you step away and you're like, well, you know what? If something happens, it happens. But until then, I'm not going to be paralyzed by this fear of not having insurance. Because what does it do? It just is like, all right, well, let me make double sure that I'm healthy. Let me make sure I'm eating right. Let me make sure I'm exercising. The danger of having this, you know, perceived safety net is like, all right, well, then I can eat like shit and not exercise because I can get all the pills and potions for, you know, a lesser amount. And you think about that, that's completely opposite from what we actually need people to be thinking about.
I saw on your socials a few weeks ago, maybe, that you got some test results back from your fire service days and how you had specific things in your blood. And the same issue is here. When people work for the oil companies, they have so many problems when it comes down to later in life issues because of the oil, the crude oil, the chemicals that they've been surrounded by. And with yourself, you know, I can't remember the exact stuff that I read, but is that detrimental for future, for your health?
So PFAS, they're called forever chemicals. Now, I'm incurable optimist. So the people that I've just had, you know, approach me about 6 months ago that paid for this blood test are developing a probiotic that it looks is going to be able to pull those out the human body. So that's a beautiful opportunity where someone can make some money on a very natural medicine that truly will make a difference. So I'm all about supporting something like that. That's preventative, that's proactive. But yeah, they were created by DuPont. So all the waterproofing that you see, the Teflon pans, and then in my job, the waterproofing in our gear that we're, you know, sweating in and wearing for hours at a time, the foam that we use to fight fire, they're all riddled with this stuff. So it is directly linked to a host of things, from cancers to neurodegenerative disorders. And so, yeah, so it's terrifying. Now, the other side of the coin is obviously, again, making the body as healthy as possible. So hopefully it doesn't succumb to this stuff. But that is supposedly, I forget, it's something terrifying, like 95% of the world's population has this in their body because it does not break down, doesn't degenerate. So you've got, you know, the ability now, hopefully, to maybe remove it from the humans. But then there's obviously this whole environmental push. It's like, well, how do we get it out of the environment? Because if they did a test on you, I mean, you've been in the West as well, even though you spent all that time in, in the Amazon and these kind of remote areas, even some of the guys that you were just talking about that are indigenous to that specific area, I guarantee you.
Oh, for sure.
Just the pollution, like you said, from the oil company, there's probably elements of it in there too. So this is what's so disgusting.
Absolutely.
This is a very, 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 very recent problem. And you think about the last, you know, two or three generations, how much they fucked up this planet based on pure power and greed. Yeah. And as you alluded to, it's not even us. It's our children, our grandchildren, our great-great-grandchildren. What is going to be left for them? It's going to be like the Lorax.
Yeah, of course. It's definitely scary. And a lot of the people around here are worried that the oil companies in their area and the people of their family who are working with the oil companies are going to later on have incurable diseases, which will ultimately end their life.
Yeah, which is unacceptable because as you just were talking about, you know, there's all this plant medicine around you. And this is, I think, just to underline your point, a very lesser known thing about modern medicine is pretty much all the chemicals that work are the ones that are, you know, duplicating a naturally occurring substance. All the ones that are shit, they just made up. And those are the ones that, you know, three paragraph warning at the end might include, you know, shitting yourself to death and all these other things. But if you look at the ones that are most effective, you know, they actually derive from a plant or, you know, insulin from a pig or, you know, whatever the thing is. So the answer is in nature. And this is what's so disgusting is, you know, why not just allow that to be taken in its modern form, its natural form, rather than say, well, I want to oppose any natural production of this thing, synthesize it, and then charge 100 times what it would cost to the consumer.
Yeah, for sure. No, I think nature is definitely a therapy. For sure, it saved my life. And it's one of the biggest reasons why we at Emerald Arch want to bring on the Veterans Nature Therapy Program is because we want to bring people who are struggling to nature. And we want to continue to help not just the environment, but the people in this world who are struggling deeply. It's one of them things where it's going to take a lot of time. It's going to take a lot of energy and work and effort. But ultimately, if we can save one person's life from, you know, destruction, to be in this incredible place, just to kind of change their mindset slightly. For me, and, you know, I don't know if you remember from the previous podcast, but like we talked about how it only took me about 14 days to really, it took me about 14 days to really realize that my life had meaning. And after that 14 days is where I spent the next 14 days and I was in my element. And so if we can change the viewpoint of just one person's life, and we can save their life, that's incredible. At the same time as saving this place, at the same time of giving local people jobs, at the same time of helping this place with reforestation, doing scientific research so we can see how many, you know, animals we have on specific lands. Like, we just collected our camera traps a few days ago. This place, you can probably hear the road so close, but the land goes in that way 2.6 kilometers and, you know, it's about 300 meters wide. It's a very kind of skinny plot of land, but very long. So incredible streams, incredible areas. So I put up 15 cameras before I left in April, and we had giant anteater, we had tamandua, jaguar, ocelot, giant armadillo, nine banded armadillo, tyra, grison, which blew my mind, short-eared dog, monkeys that are coming down, you know, I could go on with paca, agoutis, birds eating snakes, like all of these different things. And this is just one section of land, which is 184 acres. Imagine what we can do when we protect 3,000 plus acres, which is going to be destroyed by oil companies in the next 2 to 3 years, guaranteed, because they're not going to buy the 3,000 acres. They're going to buy about 40. And then what they're going to do is they're going to dump the crude oil in somewhere in that area because it's their land. And then when it's rainy season, the oil is going to disperse across the whole place and make its way down the stream to the community of Pasibien. So the importance that we have is not just saving community lives, not just helping people with PTSD, not just protecting this environment and all these people. It's a combination of so much more. And a lot of people in this world fear that leap of faith. And for me, I'm not going to stop until it's completed, dude. Like, this is it. And who knows, we might do a podcast in another 2 years or whenever it'll be. I can guarantee you there's going to be change, because that's my mindset. That's my goal. And that only happened after I had that experience and that love in the jungle. If I had never had that epiphany, if I had never had that moment of clarity where I thought suicide is not your option, you have people at home who love you, you have a great and bright future ahead of you, all you need to do is make that leap of faith, say yes to things, put yourself in uncomfortable situations, and the most important thing is follow your heart and follow the fire in your gut. Because if you don't follow what you need to follow, if your brain is telling you to go left and you're fighting to go right, because that right move will put you exactly where you need to be at exactly the right moment, which will make for incredible stories and will make for memories that you'll never, ever forget. If I had not, when I was in Australia, for example, I left Peru because Khan was killed by a poacher's trap. Devastated me. Actually shook me to the core and broke me as a human being. If I hadn't have gone to Australia, I never would have had the energy to go back. Because when I was in Australia, I remember speaking to my friend Matthew, and he said to me, like, what's next? And I said, something is unfinished in Peru. Something is unfinished. I don't know what it is, but I need to go back. I didn't want to go back. This is a place where my son had been killed. This is a place where I'd just terrible shit. I needed to go back and I didn't know why, but I followed my heart and I went back and then Keanu was there. And then because Keanu was there, I was able to make a documentary which changed people's viewpoints and changed people's lives. Not only that, but I found my wife. She came to the jungle at the very, very end of 2019. And without her, I never would have been able to have accomplished this. And it's like, if I hadn't have followed my gut instinct, if I hadn't have followed my heart, who knows where I would be? And I think that's one of the things that I'm very proud about in myself and in my life, is that when I have a feeling, I go with it. I have to, because if I don't, I will regret not following my heart.
Well, you mentioned Khan, you mentioned Keanu, and you said that there were ocelot, you know, where you are now. Have you had any sort of interaction? Have you been able to actually be there, or are they just caught on camera at the moment?
These ones at the moment are just on camera trap. I found the tracks. I found the male spray territorial marks, and I've been able to be close enough that I know that there is a good amount here. I have not found any with my eyes at the moment. And I definitely have not found an ocelot, which is definitely in need of reintroducing. I think if that happened, me and my wife would definitely have to have a talk, because she knows what I'm like. However, when I was on the plane down here, my friend Hilva messaged me and he goes, "Oh, I'm sorry, Harry." And I was like, "Oh no, what is it?" And he sent me a video of him going into one of the houses on the property, and there was three orphaned kittens there. And I was like, "Oh, don't touch them, because I want the mum to be able to come back if she's there." And then when I got here, I saw all three. So I left some food out for the mum. And when I came back the next day, the mum had taken the two healthy ones and left the runt to basically die. So now I have a kitten that I'm looking after. It's not an ocelot, but it's a stray cat. And we're going to do our absolute best to make sure that that doesn't reproduce on this land and has a way better life than just a feral cat life. But there's plenty of stuff on this land, man. There's an incredible amount of diversity. And I think that the abundance and richness of this place is going to change many people. I want to continue to bring people out here. I would love to bring you out here if that's something that you'd be interested in.
Absolutely.
It's one of them things where just even waking up to the sound of parrots and macaws and just being able to kind of like be, God, this freaking horsefly keeps biting me. Just being able to kind of like be in nature and just be surrounded by the beauty. It's like, it's something not many people truly experience in their life.
When you're talking about, in this case, a veteran in crisis, one of the things of having so many conversations, and a lot of people on the show have been in that place, they really have. And even some of the people that they're not on here talking about their powerful mental health journey, and we find ourselves there and they're like, okay, that's another person that was struggling. I didn't even realize. But there's such a powerful common denominator with all of these stories where obviously, you know, when people are hurting, they want the suffering to stop. That's part of it. But, and I think we talked about this last time, this perception that they are a burden to the people that they love. And if they just remove themselves, then everyone will be happier. Completely distorted reality. But people get there because of this kind of perfect storm of all the factors. It's never one thing. Oh, well, you had that divorce. Oh, well, you lost a child. You know, whatever the thing was, that was just one of these things. So I can see how when, you know, whoever it is, a veteran, that, you know, whatever background someone has, that they are removed from, as we mentioned earlier, this kind of white noise effect of where they were currently, you know, existing, and they find themselves in the Amazon and they have nature and they're probably going to have exercise and they're going to sleep deeper and they don't have these phones and these social media things going off. And obviously they're not having to go to work for that period of time. You can see how you then start disassembling all of those pieces of that perfect storm to where they're able to think clearly and go, wait a second, I'm not a burden. you know, I've got some things that I need to work through, and I was kind of angry towards my kids and whatever the thing was, but I can start to see why that was the case. And now I can have the ability now to work on that. So what you're doing, immersing someone into a place like, you know, in, Emerald Arch, I mean, it just makes so much sense. You know, there's so many different, you know, healing modalities out there. And the project I'm working on with my show, I want to, you know, bring light to those. In fact, that's something I think that I'd love to get you on as part of that project as well. But when people find the thing that resonates with them, someone might be like, I couldn't think of anything worse than going to the middle of the Amazon. Okay, that's not that's not the trip for you then. Maybe ayahuasca, or maybe MDMA, or maybe just, you know, equine therapy, whatever your thing is. But there's so many people that if you can just remove them from the nucleus of their turmoil and put them somewhere where they literally, you know, are totally in touch with nature, it makes so much sense that that would, you know, of course we use the word healing, but ultimately would start stripping away all those contributing factors that led them down that dark path in the first place.
Absolutely. And with the kind of disconnect of modern and social kind of like life, when you are in the jungle with somebody and you are, you know, completely kind of like disconnected from the outside world, the amount of genuine, serious conversations that you have with these people become life-changing. And a lot of my closest friends that I still hold dear to my heart are the people that I met when I first came to the jungle, because I didn't have a phone. I didn't have, you know, internet. I didn't have any of these things. I had an experience where we were all in a jungle together, all finding cool and incredible species, doing everything that we, you know, were doing, but genuinely. Not because we were doing it for social media, not because we were doing it for this or, you know, trying to impress people. We were there because we wanted to be there. And to bring people into that and to be able to kind of like have them deep conversations, it changes people. You get to know that true person and what they're genuinely going through. You don't need to hide your secrets when you're in the jungle. Not at all.
Well, I want to get to the book in a minute, but before we do, talk to me about what's needed for the purchase of the land, for the creation of the retreat. You know, for anyone listening now that might have maybe one of the pieces of the jigsaw puzzle, what is needed so that you can achieve your goal, help healing, you know, veterans, and keep these oil companies at bay?
Yeah, so I've been networking a lot recently, trying to figure out funding. Funding right now is the most crucial part because of the fact that we have a very limited amount of time. I spent the last 5 years making connections with local communities and local people so that they can actually have trust in somebody like me and my organization. So right now, funding is extremely important. If people know anybody who, you know, happens to have quite a lot of money and wants to have a tax deductible kind of like getaway by doing something good, then that's great. I feel like the other thing that Emerald Arch kind of needs at the moment is just word of mouth. If you don't have anything to contribute to the cause, that's fine. If you believe in what we are trying to achieve and what we are currently doing here, then talk about it to people. That's one of the reasons why I love doing podcasts, is because I will be able to reach many ears that I would never be able to reach. And then their conversations will be able to go on to other people. We have a new website now, so people can go on and they can check out everything now. You know, that took a while to kind of get up and running. And honestly, just kind of like the experience itself, if people want to donate and they want to come down, but they want to actually see with their eyes where their money's going, it's a completely doable and achievable kind of goal. We have land now. I have a great amount of connections down here. I have some very close friends. And so any help in any way is fantastic. But ideally, funding would be, and you know, everybody needs money, but I feel like if people genuinely listen to the issues that are here and they genuinely want to make change, the Amazon, apart from the ocean, is the, you know, biggest absorber of carbon dioxide. This place is in such turmoil because of oil companies and deforestation and fires and all these things, that if people genuinely want to do good, just even investing into land is powerful. For example, a hectare of land is $1,000 here. So I believe my calculations, 4 hectares is about an acre. So even with $5,000, you can save a huge, huge chunk of the rainforest. And then when it comes down to saving rainforest, you're then actually giving jobs to local people that are educating themselves more in why this place is important to save. And also bringing people down here who are struggling deeply. There's a lot that conversation and funding can do here, for sure.
When you say saving the Amazon, I feel like Jeff Bezos needs to give a lot of money, because he's used that word to make a lot for himself. It seems like it would be a good fit for him to give back.
If anybody's got any connects to him, that would be great. But I know that his money is going elsewhere. You know, I can't hate on somebody for making money from, you know, being very intelligent and doing all these things. But I feel like with all of the billionaires in the world, we could definitely make a difference when it comes down to mental health support, when it comes down to homelessness, when it comes down to Amazon conservation, when it comes down to just genuinely, you know, everything that is a struggle in this world. I feel like that is the thing that they could definitely change the most. But unfortunately, it takes a lot of good people to do the small things in the world. And we're trying. We're doing our complete best here.
I am, like I said, incurably yet angry optimist. And I truly believe that there is the beginning, the cracks of a revolution of kindness and compassion. I think there's an awakening of the corporate greed and some of the things that we talked about. And I hope that that's going to extend not only into physical and mental health in the developed nations and obviously beyond mm-hmm. that, but also in the conservation side. You know, this kind of eye rolling about the ozone layer, for example. I've always said, well, just look at the quality of the air in London or LA or, you know, Mumbai. You don't need to worry about the ozone layer. You can physically see it, the trash in the yeah. oceans and all these other areas. So for too long, we've kind of been duped, almost like defending these corporations. And I feel like now finally there's an awakening. And I hope even the holistic healing side will start protecting, you know, the Amazon, some of these other areas from a medicinal point of view, too. So I hope Absolutely. That the timing is right and that there'll be people leaning into nonprofits like yours to be able to help.
Yeah, I hope so, too. And I appreciate that kind of confidence. I feel like there are definitely people that are wanting to do change, and there are many, many change makers in the world. It's just that we need to work together. One of the issues that I've found working in conservation for the past 10 years is the fact that when one person does something which is great, people in conservation to some degree get jealous and they want to do something great themselves. And you end up actually having kind of like, not necessarily fights, but people are clashing heads because they're trying to do good, but they're trying to outdo each other. And so I feel like with a lot of these people that want to do good, if we just work together, we can make so much. We don't need to outsmart each other or do the next best thing. Like, I don't want someone to just like come up to me and be like, oh, well, you did this, this, and this, so I'm going to do this. It's like, oh, well done for doing something good. You know, I feel like I have also done something good. How about let's collaborate and let's do something which works for the both of us so that we can truly make a huge difference. But then again, you know, throughout the world, jealousy is kind of one of the biggest kind of like horrible things that happens. It just kind of, it causes issues.
I see that even in, you know, first responder nonprofits, and I'll get people say, and it's coming from a beautiful place. You know, I want to, I had my own mental health struggle. I'm going to start a nonprofit. And I tell them the same thing. Find a nonprofit that you already like. Find one out there that's been well established and join them. Be part of their team. Yeah. If everyone's reinventing the wheel, there's so much wasted energy. So as you said, collaborate. If you're already a, you know, an established nonprofit, then link arms with another one. And if you're not, if you're someone wanting to do good, then find someone who's already working there. And then whether it's fundraising, whether it's boots on the ground, be part of an organization that's trustworthy, that's already established, so you're not spinning your wheels and spending, you know, thousands on establishing your, you know, nonprofit only to kind of watch it struggle a year later.
Yeah. Yeah. The reason we started our nonprofit in this area is for the fact that we don't see a lot happening for the oil companies here, and we don't see anything happening for the local communities. Me and Lexi discussed, you know, a lot about kind of like what we want to do with our life and our future. And obviously making a difference was the biggest thing. And then when we both came to Ecuador together, I had been here before her, but when we both came, we saw a demand that was not being met. And that demand was respect of the local communities and education on kind of oil and the issues and impact that it has. And there's not many people like us that want to kind of work with conservation, with mental health, with local communities, with all of these things combined. And so if there are any other people out there that like this story and want to talk about it, and if there are people that want to collaborate on anything as well in the future, our ears are open, our doors are open. We want this place to heal, just like, you know, myself, like I needed to heal when I came to the jungle, but this jungle needs healing now, and it's our time to step up and pay back what was given to me.
I couldn't agree more. Well, talk to me then about the book.
Oh man, I'm not very good at writing. I feel like I'm okay, but like I didn't do well in school for the fact that I just can't sit behind a screen, but it's coming along. I have a really great editor and advisor, and I have so she's my agent, and I have a story. I have a very impactful and powerful story. Something that kind of I want to be able to get out there. There's only so much that you can really get in an hour and 40 minute documentary. And for me, like there's so much backstory to a lot of where, you know, to a lot of my story, where what made me do this and how did I get to this point in my life? And there's many whys in the documentary, which is, you know, part of filmmaking is you want people to be making questions so that they keep watching, but I want people to understand the whys. So I want to, and I'm writing my book to talk about, you know, the jungle, how it saved my life. Why did I always love animals? How did I get to this point? What I want to do in the future. Stories about Khan and Keanu that nobody apart from my closest friends and family know about. Like, there's so much in-depth detail that I want to go into that this book I feel is going to be powerful. And also I want to not just, you know, conserve. Like, this is a great, I love living here and I love doing all these things, but I want to make a living from being a public speaker. I want to speak about my stories. I want to speak about my mental health. I want to be able to help and contribute to other people who are going through something similar or just struggling in general. Like I feel like my story can be a light to many people. And you know, when the documentary came out, I had so many people messaging me beautiful messages. And the one that will stick with me the most was a lady messaged me and basically was like, thank you for your documentary, because now I understand what my husband was going through after Afghanistan. Now, I didn't make a documentary to change, you know, how a relationship works in a different part of the world, but my struggle was able to be captured so that other people could relate to how other people in their lives were struggling. And that was powerful. Very, very powerful. So if my book can go into more detail about that and more people can understand why their husbands or why their kids or why their family members or friends are struggling, then that, you know, once again, I'm trying to make a difference. I'm just trying, honestly, James, I'm just trying to do good in this world. And people that try to do good don't really win a lot. We struggle and struggle and struggle until we get to a point of where we go, you know, I'm successful in what I've done, but it took about 20 years to get here.
Well, I mean, firstly, I agree. I think that was the environment, and I hope it's starting to change now, because I think the people, for example, that were just standing in the middle in a lot of these extremist years that we've had, that were demonized, this is the thing, that the most censored voice by far was the voice of common sense for a long, long time. Yeah. But I think now people are seeing the bad. So I hope that then is going to get people realize, well, then what does a good look like? And it is, you know, like yourself and so many other people had on the show that are out there. You know, a lot of them did serve in uniform and then they got out and they're like, I need to do more. And this is, you know, this is what's so admirable. They're not paid to do this. They decided to do it off their own back. But the other thing is also storytelling. And I'm sure if you look at, you know, again, the Ecuadorian culture, there's a lot of that. You look at, you know, ancient British, ancient Egyptian, ancient insert area here. It was storytelling, hunting and, you know, war and gathering and don't eat this, but do eat this. And, you know, plagues and, you know, famine and all these things. It was all told from generation to generation. And I think we've really lost that in the kind of 7-second TikTok bullshit that we've been exposed to. So this is where I think there's a lot of power in long form podcasts and in documentaries and in books, is when you pull someone into a story. And this is what I'm hoping with my most recent project. When they get to the end of that series or, you know, the book, put it down and go, I'd never thought of it that way. And then, like you said, you leave them with questions, not all the answers, because no one has all the answers. And then they go off on their own healing journey because you've inspired hope and you've given them a few tools so they can start taking those few steps. So I think there's such a need for exactly what you're talking about.
I appreciate that. And I think that what we are both trying to do is just shine a light onto, you know, anything. It's, you know, it's mental health is a huge crisis in the world, in, you know, in England and even here, even though these people are happy, like they're fighting a battle with like, do I work with this oil company? Do I do this? Do I do that? Like, it's a struggle wherever we go, but if we can shine light on the hopeful stories in the world and try and bring, you know, something to local people or to just to do good, we're doing what we intended to do and we're doing what we must. I'm just really grateful that I have people like yourself and people like my wife and my team and family that support me in the things that I'm doing, because trying to do things alone in this world to make change is not easy. And if you're trying to do something alone in your mental health, forget it. You need to have somebody, whether you know them or whether you just need to, you know, listen to someone that has gone through something else, or whether you just need a conversation or a friend or something. If you try to do everything alone, you're never going to win. You're never going to be successful. The greatest thing, and this is once again coming back to the Ecuadorian families, the greatest thing is community. And when you have community, you can move forward.
I wanted to ask you this early on, so I'm glad that we circled around. You, elements of your journey have included, you know, isolation somewhat. And obviously some of it was, you know, this incredible bond you have with ocelots and other experiences, but how are you able to balance that community element yourself with the time on your own in the jungle?
I feel like every person is unique. And for me, I love to be solo and alone, but I love to come back to comfort. And when I am surrounded by people constantly, I start to get anxious, panicked, losing my mind. Whereas like my wife, she can be surrounded by her family and friends all the time. And she might just need like a break to watch Modern Family, you know, but she can do that. And I can't. I need lots of time occasionally to be able to just go, you know what? I'm struggling. I know that I'm struggling. What I need is a slight break. And then I go off into the forest. The times in the documentary and the times that I have spent alone, I spent a lot of time alone. It wasn't easy. I remember one time I was cooking dinner and I put on some music and I went to sing and my voice cracked like I was a 13-year-old boy again, because I hadn't spoke to anybody for 4 or 5 days. I hadn't opened my mouth. I didn't need to, you know, like I had drank water and brushed my teeth. That was the only movement that my jaw did. And it was like, I went to sing and I was like, wow, when did I last speak to somebody? And it was days and days. And, you know, after months of being alone in the jungle, my mental health wasn't great. Even though I was in the most beautiful place in the world, I struggled because I didn't have that community that I needed. However, with moderation, everything is great. If I spend 5 or 6 days in the rainforest here, just catching snakes and photographing things and having fun, and then I come back to my family, my dogs and my wife and my friends, I am then complete. And I feel like a lot of people, they need to understand what works for them. The macaws have come in, sorry. And what works for them can be different in absolutely everybody. But for me, I need to have alone time so that I can reflect, and I need to have together time so that I can use what I've thought about and reflected on to then make my relationships and friendships and work kind of balance better.
I had the author of a book, The Introvert's Edge, on the show a few years ago, and I remember him giving me the definition of an introvert and an extrovert. And he said, everyone thinks that introvert is someone who's just quiet. He said, what defines you is where you get your energy from. And I was like, okay. Oh, because that's me as well. Like, I can be in crowds and be fine. But as I've said many times on here, you know, I'm the person at a party that, you know, either A, I'm sitting out in the garden when everyone's in the house, or I'm just like, all right, I'm out, peace, and I just disappear. Yeah. And it's not that I'm overwhelmed or having any sort of issue. It's just I've hit that wall and it's like, all right, I need to go and recharge. So it seems like that's expandable. You know, for you, it's several days. For mm-hmm. some people, it might just be, you know, walking the dog for an hour. But I'm that same thing. And if you truly draw your power from crowds and from people in that community, then yeah, you're probably more of an extrovert, a true extrovert. But I think mm-hmm. a lot more of us are introverts than we realize. And that, I think, is one of the backstories for alcohol use. There's a lot of people that think they should be the life of the party, that pregame before they even go out, so they can be comfortable in crowds, because they don't realize that it's actually normal to not feel completely comfortable in a crowd. Because going back to ancient humans, you know, we weren't surrounded in this tiny space by, you know, 300 human beings. You know, it's a very abnormal thing. Same as being on stage. Yeah. You're not supposed to be like, everyone's watching you and you alone. So when you break it down, it's interesting that, yeah, the community is really important. But there would have been a lot of times in, you know, ancient human lives where we were foraging, hunting, whatever, we would have had mm-hmm. time to just be on our own and reflect. And finding that balance in modern society, I think, is hard. You know, you've got to really do some self-assessment.
Yeah, no, that is definitely interesting. And I've always kind of classed myself as like, when I was younger, I classed myself as like the class clown. But it was honestly because I was doing things just to get out of doing things. And I would be the fool that got sent out of class because I threw a freaking rubber at a teacher, or, you know, I was throwing pens, or, you know, just doing dumb shit. But when I would go to a party, I would be outrageous, but the next day I would feel drained, exhausted. Whereas when I'm here, even though I'm tired now, like my shoulder, like my bag was like 90 pounds or something like that. And I hiked for 3 days and just, I don't feel drained. I feel alive. But you put me in a nightclub for 3 hours, forget it. Even though I'm sober, I've been sober for 12 years now. The reason I became sober was because I, for some reason, knew deep down that I had an issue. And after Afghanistan, I was drinking and drinking because the mentality of the British Army is, you know, drink, run, have fun, drink more. And it was like, okay, cool. I guess I'll just keep drinking because this is what's expected of me. And I remember one time that I, and this is in the book as well, where the girl that I was seeing at the time, she kind of like ran up behind me as I was leaving a party, very, very drunk, and scared the absolute shit out of me. And I turned around and I, with fists clenched, went to punch whoever it was that scared me, because like, I was, you know, I'm dealing with stuff from Afghanistan. I'm drunk as hell. Like I'm in a blacked out phase. I'm depressed. I'm dark. As soon as I see her and her face and my fist is clenched, I instantly sobered up. And I remember thinking to myself, if you are getting to the point of where you can't associate kind of like good and bad, and if you can't figure out your shit because you're dealing and struggling with something, you need to take away something. And then the next day I went to a friend's house for a barbecue who I also served in the military with. I was in Afghanistan with him. And I remember he threw me a beer and I caught it, cracked it. And that smell of beer after that night of, you know, almost punching someone who I was supposed to have loved, it smelled like regret. I can't even explain what regret smells like, but it smelled like regret. And I was like, ah, mate, like I'm still hungover, mate. Like, just take it from me. I'm good. And that was the 7th of July and 12 years ago. And it was a struggle. It was a very big struggle for me being in the military and trying to be sober. But it was one of the best things that ever happened to me, because if I wasn't sober, I wouldn't be here today. I'd probably be in prison. I'd probably be, you know, I'd have warrants out for me. I was drink driving and doing dumb shit and just trying to feel normal, because what I had been through was not what any 18-year-old should have ever have gone through.
I had a police officer on the show about 6 months ago now, and she started doing, not pathology. What do you call it? Autopsy. There we go. I was having a brain fart for a second. Autopsy, as far as the events leading up to police officer suicide. So she wasn't, you know, the body itself, but kind of working out what was going on in their life. And she said every single one, they had consumed alcohol within 12 hours of their suicide. And when I think back to, you know, I still drink to this day, but when, you know, when I drank when I was clubbing and all that stuff when I was younger, there are girls that I ended up getting with that I wouldn't have if I was sober. So if alcohol, and that's just a very mild example, if alcohol can distort your judgment in such a simple scenario, now take someone who's in crisis.
Does that affect you?
Mm-hmm. And you're about to take your own life, but there's still that little voice in your head saying, no, don't do it. And then you start drinking. That voice is then silenced. And I think this is probably one of the things that saved your life, is you weren't drinking, because so many people I know, they were at the time. But, you know, if you're stone cold sober and you're young and you haven't been in the military and you go up on a high building and you go near the edge of the building, there's that hand, an invisible hand pushing you back away from the edge.
Yeah.
When you were in this crisis and you've been consuming alcohol, that hand goes behind you and it starts pushing you towards the ledge. So sure. I think, again, alcohol is a really important part of this whole conversation, is if you are struggling, that is the worst thing that you should do, because that's taken away your innate mm-hmm. defense capability of resisting the urge to take your own life.
That's a really interesting way of thinking about it. I know that obviously with alcohol, your kind of like perception is skewed for sure, and you'll do things that you don't normally do, but for her to have acknowledged prior to these autopsies that, you know, basically 100% of people who have committed suicide have had alcohol in their system. And we know this. We know this as people, that alcohol is the worst substance that anybody can take because it's legal and everybody thinks it's a good thing because it gives you the confidence to go talk to that person, or it gives you the confidence to get up on a mic at karaoke. And it's like this thing, you know, that gives you that energy, but it's actually that thing that gives you depression. And it's actually that thing that kind of holds you back from being a good person. You know, everything's good in moderation, but a lot of the times when I was drinking, I was making very bad decisions. And, I regret doing a lot of things in my life, but I definitely do not regret stopping drinking alcohol, because that has truly saved my life and made me the person I am today.
One more area, then I want to go to some closing questions so I can let you go. Earlier you were talking about one of the guys that you were hiking with having all that stuff on his back. In the town that I'm living in now, there's all these storage areas popping up, you know, storage for people's stuff from their home, storage to store, you know, Winnebagos and boats and all these things. And we have been driven to this extreme consumerism, again, through our television. You're not a man, Harry, unless you have a Ram truck and a, you know, fifth wheel and jet skis and, you know, dirt bikes and et cetera. And I think that really found legs pre-crash of 2008, where everyone was refinancing their home and buying all these toys, and then everything fell apart. When I traveled the world after I graduated school and then drama school and everything, I had a guitar and a backpack. That was it.
Yeah.
And I found it so liberating. And I had some stuff boxed up still at home. I didn't throw everything away, but I downsized so much to the point where if it wasn't on my back, if I couldn't carry it, then it didn't come on this trip. Talk to me about the materialism element of not only yourself, but the people that you're working amongst, and contrast to what we're told we should have in the US.
That's a great question. And honestly, to see the amount of stuff that people have is wild. Before I came here, this is, you know, several months ago now, I actually was doing a job working on a hoarder's house, and top to bottom, basement, first floor, second floor, he'd even cut out holes in his ceiling and in his bathroom walls so he could store more stuff. And that's an extreme. And then I see other people who are like, I don't want to throw that away because, you know, it has sentimental value, or I'm going to collect these things. Like here, it's one of them things where it's like, they don't just buy something if something is broken. They will do whatever they can to fix that broken thing. Or, you know, they will just have the essentials of what they need, because whatever else they don't need is a risk of getting lost or stolen, or, you know, is money that they could have spent elsewhere. And so for a lot of the people around here, it's one of them things that is a beautiful thing of kind of like downsizing and kind of like not really having all these essentials. I found that when I bought my house, I started collecting more things because I had space to put it. And it's one of them things where it's like, when I moved from my rental property to the house that I'm living in now, I did it in two car trips, you know, that was it, with like my staff and my wife's staff. And now if I was to move house, I would have to do several trips, because I've been able to have a wardrobe where I can put four or five more t-shirts. I've been able to have a shoe rack where I can have four or five more pairs of shoes. I, you know, have things that I have just collected over the years. Like when I threw the first pitch at the LA Dodgers game, I kept that ball that I threw and it had signatures on it. Them types of things, like, they have small meanings, but it's not necessarily like important. And I think that the people here have the things that are most important to them and the things that are most essential to thrive and live here. However, they spend their money on, you know, family and food and other things that are more important than just valuables that they kind of like associate with like good memories.
I saw a documentary a while ago and it was on, there's a term for it, I'm getting this wrong, but basically disposable fashion. So there's super cheap high street stores where you buy it, you know, I think this is less men, more women, but you know, they'll wear an outfit once and they're like, I've already worn that. And then, you know, it's kind of disguised as charitable donations and all these things are then sent and dumped in Haiti or wherever the supposed, you know, benefiting nation is, but it's just shifting trash from one country to another. And it, again, it goes back to, which I hope is going to see something that we're going to see a resurgence of, is, you know, a good pair of jeans will last you a long time. You know, a good, you know, shirt will last you a long time. And, you know, the even your furniture, if it's not this shit, you know, lamb board or chipboard and IKEA bollocks, but you actually have a real cabinet made with real wood or a dining room table, you're going to pass that on for generation to generation. So I think getting away from this, you know, I want more things and each of those things is going to be shittier quality. If we actually reinvest in something that will last, it is repairable, like you said, then that's going to have a long-term impact on everything from the amount of trash that we throw away to even the consumption of oil. Like if we go back to normal size vehicles, if you're not a tradesman and don't need a giant truck, imagine how, you know, the impact that would have on the demand for oil, and even that would have a ripple effect to where you are right now.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's crazy the amount of things that we think we need and the things that we actually need. But it's, you know, everybody's guilty of it. Everybody has things that they kind of like collect, have, love, enjoy, have memories connected to, but yeah, I feel like a lot of people here, they have memories which are in their heads and not on their phones or not as like valuable items. It's the memories here are more important than the actual physical item.
So one of the last questions for you, when do you think the book will be out and do you have a title for it yet?
Well, I am hoping to finish my book on my first draft at the end of this year. I'm then hoping to get an editing kind of situation going. And I know that that takes a while. And then with kind of like publishers and all these types of things, it could take another year. So I'm expecting the end of next year that the book will be out. I have a few names for them. And one which is in the kind of the air at the moment is like Gifts from the Darkness. I feel like a lot of the times where I've had my darkest moments and my darkest things have actually been a gift and have actually been a hand to basically say, take this, you know, you're going through some shit, you're struggling, everything's going to shit around you, nothing is great, but this is a moment and a pivotal moment, kind of going back to what we kind of started with at the beginning of this podcast. This is a moment that is going to shape you. And so these dark moments aren't necessarily looked at and viewed as negatives now. They're actually viewed as kind of positives, because if I didn't do so-and-so, I wouldn't be here because of that. If I didn't go to this place and struggle, I wouldn't be here now because of this. So Gifts from the Darkness is one of them. And then if I don't really like that, I also kind of like the name Through the Eyes of an Ocelot, because a lot of the things that I'm kind of looking at now is via my boys, and I've done everything that I could through them. And to see life differently is to see life how an animal would see it, or to see it how somebody else who is living in an incredible place and who is just having the best time of their life, like swimming in a stream and, you know, doing whatever, because like everybody is viewing things through their own eyes. But if you look at it from somebody else's perspective or an ocelot's perspective, you can really truly gain to appreciate.
The kind of concept that you were talking about with the first title is something I think we need to see a lot more of. I've made this kind of observation recently, and this is what my most recent book was about, was in the mental health conversation, we understand that we need to smash the stigma. That's been the message for a long time, but that doesn't get you any closer. It just really is saying, hey, when people are struggling, don't be a dick. That's pretty much it.
Yeah.
You know, create an environment.
Ask how your friends are doing and, you know, kind of go the correct route. But like, how do you personally see that?
Yeah. Well, then I think, so the next thing is the hope of post-traumatic growth. And that's what you're talking about. Just bang my mic. You know, when you can work through this and you found your own unique toolbox, whether it's, you know, a month in the Amazonian jungle or whether it's, again, some retreat or simply just talk therapy with someone that you trust, whatever your thing was, mm-hmm. now you can reflect back and see the gifts that you were given in these traumas. So I think that there's so much, you know, power to that hope of, you know, look where Harry is now. Look where Harry was. You know, he's a completely different person now. He's not who he was before he went to war. He's a different person now, but he's got more resilience, more compassion, more empathy. So I think that's such a needed conversation now, is the storytelling of the hope of the 2.0 version of yourself that then will drive you through whatever your own kind of crucible is to get there.
Yeah. I feel like a lot of people see me and see the change that I have become, and they use somewhat of the term of like, you know, Harry is healed. I'm not healed. What I have done is I have learned to accept the challenges that I have had in life. I've learned to try and see things differently. I've learned that, you know, everything happens for a reason, but like, I think what I've truly learned is that if you just do the things that you want to do and that you feel is important, you will never be disappointed in yourself. And I still have days, like negative days, where I contemplate suicide and I think about self-harm and I think about, you know, absolute just terror and horribleness. But I also now can associate with my mental health that, you know, that is one of them things where it that's part of life. What I need to do now and with age and with all these things is that, you know, you're never going to be healed, but what you can do is you can kind of like, you can use what you know now about your body, your mental health, your physical health, all these things. And you can say, look, it's just one of them bad days, but one of these bad days is going to be a good day soon.
Absolutely. Well, for people listening, where's the best place to find Emerald Arch online, and then any other social media handles you want to do as far as your own projects too?
Yeah, so Emerald Arch is www.emeraldarch.org, and we're also on Instagram with emerald.arch. And I'm hoping to start a YouTube channel soon, but oh my God, I've got so much going on that I'm just trying to do all the important stuff right now. But YouTube will be up soon, and we'll get some, you know, cool videos from the land and, you know, some of the cool stuff that we found. And we just put some plaques up on some really cool trees on the land to honor some of the beautiful people that have passed away. One of them being a very good friend of mine, Dana, who died of cancer 2 years ago. And so it's what we're doing is we're collecting content. We're doing all these things so that we can really truly show people what this land is about, how we can help local people, how we can do all these things. So I'm honored for you to ask me to be on again. Thank you so much for, you know, this opportunity to spread the word about what we're doing here and the good and positive that we're trying to achieve in this place. Keep your eyes out, dude, because we're going to be doing some good stuff and we're going to be making big moves in the next few years. We're going to be making big changes here. But if anybody does have a spare $1 million, let me know, because that's what's going to really help us.